the lowest prices, period. They guarantee it. Wow, right? Well, I guess I shouldn't be too surprised. I did find the pharmacy in a Walmart.
One great pharmacy, lots of low prices. Save money, live better. Walmart.
You're listening to 1460 WVOX, the official station of New Rock City, the place where you can enjoy a wholesome family entertainment experience.
Get your weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by calling the Whitney Radio Weather Phone at 914-636-7026, a service of Union State Bank. Now at Union State Bank, free checking, no monthly charges, no per check fees. Just $100 to open at Union State Bank. Union State Bank sponsors the Whitney Radio Weather Phone at 914-636-7026. That's 914-636-7026.
Here's the updated weather forecast for Westchester County and vicinity. It looks like we're going to have some mixed precipitation today. It's going to start off as a little bit of snow, but then over to some sleet and some freezing rain during the afternoon, or some rain. All depends on the exact location that you might be in. The central and northern portions of Westchester, away from the sound and away from any body of water, will have temperatures that will average between 3 to 5 degrees colder. And in those places, it will be a longer period of snow, and there could be as much as 4 to 8 inches of snowfall up there. Southern Westchester, close to the city, that's where temperatures are going to be close to freezing. And aloft, it's going to be a little bit milder. So during the afternoon, it'll be a greater period of what we call sleet or ice pellets. And that can accumulate on the ground, coat and cover the ground and make it quite icy. But it doesn't accumulate like snowfall, so the amounts there will be less, probably closer to a couple of inches, maybe as much as 4 in some colder spots further north. Then we get into some freezing drizzle for tonight. Back into some fair weather for Friday before the next storm arrives sometime this weekend. A chance of some snow to rain later Saturday and early Sunday. So winter weather advisories and winter storm warnings in effect for the area. Snow and sleet today, generally a couple of inches in some spots to as much as 4 to 8 further north, and temperatures of 30 to 35. Mostly sunny on Friday. Friday's highs in the middle 40s. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX and WVIP, the Whitney Radio Network.
The latest forecast from the 1460 WVOX Weather Center, brought to you by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center, right for New York.
At Entergy, meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
Hi, honey, I'm home.
Hi, dear, I'm in on the computer.
What are you doing?
Applying for our 2007 New York State Middle Class Star Property Tax Rebate Check. As homeowners, we can get a rebate on our school taxes just by filing an application with the New York State Tax Department. I just got the application. Now, all I have to do is go to the Tax Department website at nystax.gov, and the rest is easy.
What do they want from us?
Just the names and Social Security numbers of the property owners, and a daytime phone number just in case. That's it. I could mail it in, but I'm going to apply online. It's safe and secure, and we'll get the rebate check faster.
It's that easy?
It's that easy. I'm already done.
The deadline to apply for the 2007 New York Star rebate check is December 31st. Senior citizen homeowners who receive the enhanced Star exemption get their checks automatically. For more information, go to our website at nystax.gov or call 1-877-678-2769.
Sponsored by the New York State Tax Department in cooperation with the New York State Broadcasters Association.
This is John Fix III from Cornell's True Value Hardware. For years, you've heard me talk about our family-owned hardware store in Eastchester and how we love helping our neighbors with all their home improvement needs. I've told you about our great service and selection and the wonderful associates who work at our store. And now I want to tell you about True Value Rewards, an exciting program that benefits you, our loyal customer. True Value Rewards is a free program that allows you to earn points and discounts on all your purchases. True Value Rewards members get 1 point for every dollar they spend at our store, and each time you accumulate 250 points, we'll mail you a certificate for $10. In addition, each month, selected products at Cornell's are specially priced exclusively for you, our True Value Rewards customer. And did I tell you that the program is free? Even better, when you sign up, you'll receive double points on your first purchase. For more information and to sign up, please stop by. The Cornell's Hardware Store is in Eastchester, between Scarsdale and Bronxville, on Route 22. Cornell's True Value Hardware, serving Westchester homeowners since 1909.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Good morning. Good morning, and welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Lebensold, your host for the series on the natural world, education, and culture. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, December 13th, 2007, the 82nd day of autumn. We have lost 1 minute of daylight since yesterday, 54 minutes since last we met 5 weeks ago. The reason Environmentally Sound was not heard for all that time is that regular programming was suspended on Thanksgiving Day, and there were five Thursdays in November. We now resume our regular schedule of every second and fourth Thursday of the month. The sun rose at 7:11 this morning. It will set at 4:27 this evening. We will have 9 hours and 16 minutes of daylight today. The moon will rise shortly at 10:19, about 10 minutes, and it will set at 8:09 this evening. We are between new moon and first quarter phase, and the next full moon is Christmas Eve. The next time we meet, the season will have changed. The winter solstice is December 22nd, and we can get back on track gaining minutes instead of losing them each day, as it has gone on since time began and will continue until it ends. Next high tides in New Rochelle at 12:43 p.m. That's shortly. In Yonkers, 11:05 a.m. Okay, I'm not doing very well with this morning. 11:05 a.m., which is shortly. In Dobbs Ferry, 11:33 a.m. That's enough of the tides for today. If you're going out boating, you have to look it up yourself. Our regular feature now, names of American service members who have lost their lives in Iraq. May they live on in all of our hearts. Kyle Dayton, age 22, of the Army, El Dorado Hills, California. He died December 3rd. Matthew K. Reese, 24, of the Army, Harrison, Arkansas, died on December 1st. Emery W. Blair, 24, of the Army, from Lee, Maine, died on November 30th. John J. Tobiasen, 42, of the Army, from Bloomington, Minnesota, died November 28th. And Jermaine D. Franklin, 22, of the Army, Arlington, Texas, died on November 9th. All of these men were alive when last we broadcast this program 5 weeks ago. Four men died on this date in 2005. This is their second anniversary of their death. Michael S. Zyla, Peter J. Navarro, James C. Kessinger, and Brian C. Karim, all of the Army. May these American servicemen live forever in our hearts, and may this feature come to an end in the very near future, because there are no more deaths to report. Time for the Culture Corner, my reviews of plays, ballets, opera, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions, and you have the right to differ from them, because everyone has the right to be wrong. Okay, today we are reviewing a production of the Metropolitan Opera, which I attended last Saturday, called Romeo and Juliet. Now, reviewing a Metropolitan Opera production is a challenge insofar as there is no such thing as a bad one. True, there are superstars and lesser singers, but even the lesser singers are great and can be heard throughout the cavernous, though acoustically sound, Grand Hall, which is the Metropolitan Opera Theater in Lincoln Center. Last Saturday's production of Romeo and Juliet, music by Charles Gounod, was as moving as Shakespeare's enduring classic should be. Grand love counterpointed with grand hatred, magnificent gestures and hot-blooded murder, all leading to grand double suicide, which echoes through the annals of time, along with Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake Ballet, in which ill-fated lovers ascend together to the heavens, too pure for life on this mortal coil. Now, there are just so many magnificent and powerful voices to go around, so after all the world's opera companies and all of the Met soloists who are doing other operas are accounted for, there is a certain fall-off among the supporting roles. But both Joseph Kaiser as Romeo and Anna Netrebko as Juliet are up to the challenge, and in voice and chemistry bring home the roles. The Met subtitling system is subtle and tasteful, so you can read your personal little screen without disturbing your seatmate. These unobtrusive monitors minimize the dialogue and give you just what you need to follow the storyline. When this great tragedy unfolds with such opulent costumes and imposing sets, it touches a place which mere words cannot, and that is the grandeur of opera. The first scene after intermission, the lover's bed floats 15 feet above the stage, and the two are making sweet romantic love. Nice touch in set design. The intensity and brevity of their love brings to mind the delicate mayfly, which lives but a day in its mating intensity. When they sing to each other with their final breaths, "'Tis sweet, O infinite supreme joy, to die with you," we understand their love is just too pure to find a home on this flawed mortal coil. The orchestra was conducted by Placido Domingo, the famous tenor who had just sung the role of Oreste that very afternoon. Later this season, we will see Lucia de Lammermoor, which we will certainly review for you. Now, this Romeo and Juliet opera will be broadcast live this Saturday, December 15th at 1 p.m. to over 600 cinemas worldwide. If you'd like to look up where it is close to you, just go to metopera.org, and if you can remember this, /HDLive. But metopera.org is what you need to go for. That's this Saturday. My first guest is Barry Charles Hoffman, founder, director, spiritual leader, and conductor of the Westchester Chamber Orchestra. And what a conductor he is. Forget about a man in dress tails who stands waving his baton blandly on his podium before a fairly good regional orchestra. There's nothing bland about Barry's conducting, and there is nothing fairly good about this orchestra. Barry is a wonderfully dynamic conductor who someday will bounce right off his podium if he doesn't enlarge it. And it is an excellent orchestra which he conducts. The only part that he does keep is the tails. Welcome, Maestro Barry Charles Hoffman.
Thank you so much. Good morning. Of course, you've heard of the Tales of Hoffman, so...
Barcarolle is the famous piece from there, right? Yes, that's right. Well, Barry cuts a fine figure up there. He's in his casuals today, but what we are hearing right now is a Bach air, is it not?
Correct, from his D major suite.
From Bach's D major suite, and this will be part of your concert this Saturday, right, Barry? Tell us about that, please.
Yes, thank you so much. We have and it's great to be back. Thanks for having me. 8 o'clock at Iona College this Saturday. Hopefully we'll be before any storm comes, as far as I know. In the Murphy Auditorium, we'll be performing an all Baroque program, music of Bach, and this piece you're hearing now is the Westchester Chamber Orchestra, recorded as we did it last year. And we're doing the Bach double violin concerto with our concertmaster Alex Abayev and assistant concertmaster Boris Kochechko. And we're also doing Bach Brandenburg Concerto number 3, a wonderful suite by Telemann, and also a piece for solo violin called a chaconne, which is a four-measure theme that has 31 variations on it with the soloist and the orchestra. It's a marvelous piece, and that's going to open the concert.
Will you be recording this concert?
Yes, we will.
This is one that I regret that I have to miss.
Thank you.
I especially love Bach. I love this piece he's playing now. And Telemann, I don't know which of his pieces you're playing, but
it's
Telemann
a terrific,
didn't write any
sweet,
crap.
Well, one might think that because it's predates Bach, a lot of his music. He was also the most prolific composer. He had more than 1,000 pieces that were published. That it wouldn't be as exciting, but it has so much energy and nuance. And one of the special attributes of the music of that time is the art of improvisation, where the leaders of specific sections, violin, viola, on repeating a section in the music, the first section of a movement, In the second time it was played, they would start improvising, and they don't do that anymore. Well, our concertmaster is going to do some of that.
Alex is going to do that.
Yeah. So that's it's great. A very personal way of interpreting the music.
My favorite. You know, it's almost like, you know, a lot of musicians get together and they do what they call jam sessions, but most musicians of a certain caliber, they just say, gee, look, I know all these chords. They're not really doing anything. But when you get someone like Alex Abayev or Miles Davis or people who really know their instruments and really know how to make the music in their head come through their instrument, that kind of improv is amazing.
Yeah.
And Alex is that kind of guy.
He is. And Bach was known for, in his own time, being a prolific, tremendous improvisation artist at the keyboard at that time.
Bach.
Yes.
Now, Bach, just while we're talking about Bach, he had a job, I think his main job was testing organs, was it not, for churches?
I'm not aware of that. I know he was Kapellmeister for many years, and he had to produce a cantata every week. Talk about job pressure in the advertising field. I mean, you know, if this guy were fired, you know, he'd be on the street. He had 21 children, I mean.
He had a lot of kids, some of whom also were composers of some note. I know he had a job testing organs, and rather
sure
than just play scales,
right.
he started writing pieces, and some right. of his uh-huh. great... the D minor toccata and fugue, right? And the F. Some of them are magnificent, and I don't know about those pieces in particular, but much of what he wrote for the organ was just, you know, it's getting boring playing scales. You have to play everything to make sure it works, and so he made these sublime pieces.
Right, right.
Cool. Very cool. And your wife Adele is also a violinist with the orchestra.
Correct, yes.
Let me guess, you two met over some music event somewhere at a school or something, or a concert?
Well, we met through a classical music dating service called classical music singles, and it was very lucky for both of us, we feel.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Classical music love is exchange.
I wonder what Bach and Telemann would feel about that way of getting together. Very good. Anything else? Now, has Alex called in? No. Can we call him? Okay.
He's probably practicing and with his doors closed right now, getting ready for the concert.
No, the concert Saturday. It's this Saturday at Iona College. What's the name of the auditorium again?
It's now the Christopher J. Murphy Auditorium.
And formerly, what was it?
Joyce.
Joyce.
Same
right.
Location.
Same location. It's right at Iona College, right on North Avenue in New Rochelle. If you can get there this Saturday, you're in for a treat. First of all, it's a Class A orchestra. Second of all, Barry not only is a great guy, but he's a great conductor. No bones about that. And if you like this kind of music, I highly, highly recommend that you check it out.
Thank you so much.
Now, I'd like to just tell you a little bit about my friends at The Learning Shop, as we do regularly. The Learning Shop is a tutoring service in Harrison, New York. Their telephone number, which I'll give you again, is 914-835-1070. The Learning Shop is where you send your kids when they need to improve their understanding of school subjects for any number of reasons. If they're not so good at math, not so good at reading, not so good at this or that, or they have some tests coming up, this is the place to go. It's a full-service education system, if you will. If they don't have someone on staff that knows what your kid needs or what you need, they will find somebody for you. They accommodate everyone as much as they possibly can. And anyone who's into music, not classical music on Barry's level, but playing an instrument or recording, they have a full state-of-the-art recording studio right there with many house instruments, the top-of-the-line drum machine, electronic drum set. It's $6,000 set. It's terrific. They've got several guitars and keyboards, and I go there just to hang and play sometimes. They're really, really good. So if you know any kid who needs to prepare for SATs or GEDs or GREs or any of those letter tests, the Learning Shop of Harrison, New York, in Harrison at 914-835-1070. If you tell them that Bob Levinsold sent you, they will give you the same good service they'll give you anyway if you just off the street. So you can mention my name if you want to, but it will not help you at all. They won't give you any less than their best, no matter what. Okay, You are listening to WVOX AM 1460. If you are listening in Cologne, New Jersey, Glasgow, Delaware, or Scotland, Clyde, Michigan, or Romulus, Michigan, you have logged on to www.wvox.com and you are listening live. Thank you, Barry. I'm sorry we couldn't get Alex to call in, but I would like to introduce my next guest, whose name is Rochelle Fradkin, but I want to read you what I have written. Well, my next guest is a walking miracle. That is a term that she uses for all Jews who escaped detection in France during the German occupation in World War II. Rochelle Fradkin, as a teenager in occupied France, was a member of the Resistance, which is the organized French underground. Joining us for this interview as co-host is Connie Kennedy, a history buff, especially of this period in world history. Connie's father was a navigator aboard American bombers in the European theater. Welcome, Connie, and welcome, Rochelle Fradkin.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you here, Rochelle. Connie?
Yes. I guess we'll set up your story, give a little background, and please interrupt me whenever I'm off base. In September 39, the Nazis invaded Poland, and for a good 8 or 9 months, your family, which was your mother, Rosa, your father, Abram.
Avram Yitzchak.
Your sister, Evelyn, the younger sister who was a young child at that time, lived in Paris. And during that 10 months, people felt fairly safe because they thought that it was going to stop. It would not come to Paris.
The Maginot Line would stop them, yes.
Okay. And then in May 40, the Nazis invaded Belgium, and you knew that the gig was up or whatever the term is, and they would come.
Oh, yes. We started getting frightened, yes.
Right. And that began an odyssey for your parents to keep their kids alive, to take you throughout from one place to another in search of safety.
Yes.
And you, in the summer of 40, you went down to a small town called Auvergne, is that correct?
Yes, we left Paris about 3 days before the Germans came in. And we just went there because we had some family who were there. We just didn't know where to go. And we thought we would be walking on the roads, but fortunately, we finally were able to get on a train after waiting for hours and hours. And we landed in this small town. And well, we stayed there as long as it was necessary. And eventually, France signed the armistice with Germany, and where we were all in that little town, in that main place, and everybody was crying, and France had lost the war, and well, of course, for us, it was more tragic. We didn't know what was going to happen. We know that Jews were in danger. But at the beginning, nothing happened in Paris. The Germans were very cautious. And eventually, everybody started going back to their homes. And my father figured, well, I don't think it's safe at all. And we thought the men were really in danger, not the women and children. And he didn't want to go back. So my mother didn't want to break up the family, so we decided to stay together. And eventually, we went to Lyon because that was a big city where we could find work.
And it was the Vichy government.
It was the Vichy government with Pétain at the head. Yes.
Okay. So you still felt it was, you had French.
We were French citizens, right? Not many Jews who came from other countries were French citizens because it was very difficult to become a French citizen, and we felt maybe we had a certain measure of security. But things started to deteriorate little by little, and the Vichy government took measures, I guess, by the Germans' directives, and little by little they started to persecute us, and things became very difficult. But still, we sort of led a fairly normal life. We worked, and my sister went to school.
And this was in Lyon.
And that was in Lyon.
Okay.
And eventually they started to, the Vichy government, the French police, started to take away foreign men. And they established concentration camps in France. And we felt we weren't exactly in danger, but it was a beginning. And then, of course, when it became bad, was the Allies invaded North Africa at the end of November 1942, and then the Germans came in. And we saw the trucks, and then we started to get very frightened. Then we learned that the Italians who occupied a certain part of France near the Italian border, they didn't persecute the Jews. So everybody started to run there. And we were a lot of people. We took just any apartment we could. Now, what was interesting, my father and my sister went first to Lyon, and my mother and I stayed behind to pack up things. And the day we left, we were supposed to bring the keys to, it was an organization that was legal, that the Germans allowed, because they wanted some leaders to be responsible for the Jews. And I guess it's how naive we were. There was an organization, a Jewish organization that was legal. And we were supposed to bring the keys of the apartment so someone else could use it. And my mother told me, well, I don't feel like going. Let's just go to the railroad. So we took the train, we went to Grenoble. 2 days later, we found out that very day, the Gestapo was at that place that took everybody. I mean, it was just a miracle. One of many miracles that happened.
So you call yourself a walking miracle.
Yes, well, we all were. Every Jew who survived is a walking miracle. Everybody has a story to tell. I mean, mine is really not so extraordinary.
Well, it's a one of the legend. You know, it's as extraordinary as all the rest. Surely others shared the experience. I suppose millions shared the experience.
Oh yes, yes.
Many millions, unfortunately, didn't make it past that experience.
Yeah, but many people have even more hair-raising stories to tell. You know. I mean, but well, which I won't.
Well, when we come back from break, I'm going to ask you what it was day to day in the streets of France, and some of the ways in which you did just what you were going to do anyway as a teenager, but you risked your life pretty much every day, and I think that'll be very interesting. But right now, we're going to take a break. Again, this is Environmentally Sound. I am your host, Bob Levinsohn. My co-host today is Connie Kennedy. Our guest is Rochelle Fradkin. If you are listening to WVOX AM 1460 out of New Rochelle, if you are listening in Strasbourg, Salzburg, Hamburg, or Luxembourg, or in Lyon, Marseille, Nice, or Le Havre, France, or Bayonne, or Jersey City, you have logged on to www.wvox.com, and you are listening live, and we will be right back.
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of Paige Morton Black, Premium Point, Five Island Park, and the Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
Are you flying out of Westchester this holiday season? Thinking of driving to the county airport? Well, think again. Come fly with us, but leave your car at home. With more flights to popular destinations than ever before, and with thousands of people traveling over the holidays, there's just not enough airport parking for everyone. Sure, you could get a ride from a friend or a family member, or take a taxi or a car service, but how about trying the new AirLink bus service that runs between downtown White Plains and the Westchester County Airport? Don't let a packed parking lot add to the stress of the holidays. Ride in the comfort and convenience of the new AirLink bus service that runs between downtown White Plains and the Westchester County Airport. To find options to parking at the airport, go to westchestergov.com or call 914-995-RIDE. That's westchestergov.com or call 914-995-RIDE. 914-995-RIDE. RIDE, the new AirLink bus service that runs between downtown White Plains and the Westchester County Airport.
I just bought my first house in Queens, and I want to pay off my mortgage as fast as I can. Good thing I found some tips from Con Edison to help me save money heating my home. First, I had insulation installed in my attic. Then I weather-stripped around windows and doors. Guess what? I cut my bills by almost a third. You know, the previous owners could have saved a lot if they'd done this years ago.
Visit ConEd.com for more wise energy-saving ideas. Con Edison, on.
The Bronx, Westchester, and the Islands Worldwide Forum. This is WVOX, Whitney Radio's flagship station at 1460 AM and worldwide at WVOX.com. From the ancient Latin comes our name, and from the Roman Forum for discussion and debate comes our inspiration. Vox, the voice of the people. America's most honored community radio station. WVOX and WVOX.com.
This is Ruby D. As I travel around the country, I'm struck by this unique radio station's extraordinary relationship with this community. There's always something happening right here at 1460 1460, and most of it very good.
The Strains of Beethoven. Welcome us back. You are listening to Environmentally Sound on WVOX AM 1460 out of New Rochelle. And our guest is Rochelle Fratkin. And my guest host today is Connie Kennedy. We are talking with Rochelle, who was a member of the French resistance in France during World War II. Okay, Connie.
So, Rochelle, it's late 42, your family's in Lyon, the Allies have invaded North Africa, the Germans have entered Lyon, and your family is searching for a safer area. Mm-hmm. So you move to the Italian-occupied zone in Grenoble?
Yes. And, my involvement started because we were supposed to help people who were hiding, families who were hiding, and bring them papers and move them either to other places, or Switzerland started to admit people who had small children. So what they wanted me to do is bring those papers and travel by train to these people and go with them. I went by train and take them wherever they were supposed to be. And this is what I did. And of course, there were other girls who did that. Girls were not as suspicious as boys, and usually we were not searched. But papers were asked, and IDs were asked, and of course, everything had to be in order. I didn't feel a special danger about that. We were in danger every day anyway. Well, so especially when the Italians signed the armistice in September 43, and the Germans came into Grenoble, and then we really were stuck. And now the other thing that I was asked to do is to carry pamphlets. So my father was making ladies' bags, and he made a false bottom in my bag, and that's why I had the pamphlets. So I met a fellow, he was my contact, I was told where to meet him. We just know each other's first name, not really a real name. And he would give me a package I put in the bag. And then either I was supposed to give it to someone else or go myself to apartment houses and put them in front of doors. Of course, I had some close calls when there were people. I had to be careful. But it was almost like a game. I was a young girl, and I didn't think too much of the danger. Until one time my contact didn't show up.
Until one time.
Yeah, he didn't show up. And finally I waited, and then I found out, I was told that he had been arrested by the French Nazis, who were called the milice, and they were really the dregs of the population. And of course he was killed, who knows what conditions. After that, I wasn't asked to carry those pamphlets, and somehow I felt relieved. But I still went, I traveled, and I went to help with these people and escort them to wherever they were supposed to be. I did that quite a few times, and I like that part. I mean, that was helping people directly.
And what did you do when you took the trains to people? What was your mission?
To go with them. First of all, I had to bring them their false papers, ID papers, and then go with them to their destination and bring them to wherever address they were supposed to be. And usually they were families, parents and children. And
Other Jewish families, or were there German families?
No, they were all Jews, of course. That was the whole point.
Well, yes. Schindler wasn't Jewish, and yet he helped a lot of Jews. I wondered if there were other Germans who French.
Oh, yes, of course.
That were not Jewish, that helped just out of humanitarian.
Oh, absolutely. That's how we got the papers. I mean, we had to have their help. But the Jews really worked within their own organizations. I only worked with Jews, and then I had some contact with other people. But we had to have their help. Otherwise, we couldn't do anything. I mean, that was imperative, of course.
Bob, at this time, too, Rochelle's family were passing as Gentiles.
We became very smart because the French police was able to. They were able to figure out when papers were false. So we feel we have to have real papers. So someone came up with the idea. You go to the library where they have all the names of people who are naturalized listed. For my parents could not pass for French people. They had to pass for Russian people, so Russian names they could remember. So I found names that didn't sound Jewish and were approximately their age, and I noted everything. And they were able to get blank naturalization papers. So, of course, you had to have contact with French people. And someone was able to fill out their names. And with this paper, my parents were able to go to a small village. We heard that the mayor was very good. He did not ask any questions. And, of course, as he figured he was covered, the papers were real. And he gave ID papers. So they had real ID papers under a false, under someone else's name.
So identity theft has been around for quite some time.
Yes.
It's not a new American phenomenon.
Come to think of it, that's what it was.
Now, you were Nadine Gérin, right?
No, I was Nicole Gérin. There was this girl where I worked. And I found out exactly, of course, where she was born. When you work together, you know those things. And she was born in Grenoble. She was my age.
And you actually knew her.
And, we worked together.
We worked together.
And
But you took her papers.
And a friend of mine went to the city hall, and he got a birth certificate. And with that birth certificate, I went to this town near Lyon that we heard the police did not ask too many questions. They didn't ask for proof of where you lived. That was very important. Mm-hmm. So we all went there, and so I had the perfectly real ID card under the name of Nicole Gérin, with my picture, of course, and I used it when I traveled because always ask for ID papers, and the French police could very well check if the paper was real. All they had to do is call their precinct.
They knew,
and they could tell. Yeah, we had to work very hard because of them.
Nicole didn't. She met an unfavorable end, didn't she?
Yes, she found out after the liberation that it seemed that the resistance, that they had their eye on her, and she betrayed the people, and she had them killed. I mean, it was an awful thing, and of course, I certainly destroyed my...
You destroyed your papers, and what happened to Nicole?
And she was shot, because right after the liberation, it was complete chaos, and so they were able to do that without any trial, without any anything like that.
But they knew who she was.
Oh, they knew who she was,
she
yes.
paid for it. How
and
old
she
was she?
She was a French citizen.
Oh, yeah, she was a French girl, yes.
How old was she when they killed her?
Well, she was about 21 years old. 21 years old, yeah.
Now, other girls suffered also. They were girls that fraternized with German
yes.
soldiers. What became of those
yes,
girls?
Yes, so that what happened, well, everybody knew, of course. Oh, it was right after the war. Everybody gathered together. They put those girls on top of something, a chair or something, and they shaved their heads. That was a mark of shame. That's what they did to them. Actually, of course, in a way, I felt sorry for them because what did they do? I mean, they...
They fraternized with German soldiers.
Yeah, they did. It was ambivalent, of course. You know, we all felt such hatred, you know, towards the Germans or whoever collaborated with them. But in a way, I felt so uneasy. I feel very uneasy when I remember those things.
And you witnessed
yes, I did. Oh, everybody was there. Yeah, now, we witnessed.
Any other retribution besides shaving and knocking this Nicole girl off?
Oh, for these girls, well, that was enough. I mean, you saw a girl like that with a shaved head or she wore a hat when nobody did. I mean, of course, no, everybody knew it. Grenoble was not a big town, and everybody knew them, and they were shunned, and they were shamed. And for a while, I think it was very bad for them. But there was no retribution against the French police, and they're the one who took people, especially on July 16, 1942. That was a big roundup. They came to people's home. They took the women and children. They just took everyone. It was a horrible day. That's when most of French Jews were taken at that time
and deported.
And they were first taken to Drancy, which was a French concentration camp, and they were all deported, mostly, most of them anyway. A few were able to escape, but very few. And that was a horrible thing. And of course, in a way, it wasn't expected, but I don't know why not, because certainly when you knew what went on in Poland, or in Germany for that matter, under the Nazis, we should have known, but I guess you sort in denial or something. I mean, and so that was my involvement. And thinking back, I'm proud of it. But at that time, I wasn't thinking anything. It was just something I was supposed
to do.
And my parents somehow, they knew what I was doing, but they did their part. My father hid documents for a while in our house. He made models of ladies' bags in cardboard. So between two pieces of cardboard, he put the documents. I mean, sometimes people came to hide in our apartment. I mean, for a couple of days before they could go somewhere else. We did that. People slept on mattresses and on the floor. And we all managed. We lived in very bad conditions, but we all managed. And they did their part,
too. And you were put
in
extra danger when your family did that.
Yes, I guess in a way we were, but we didn't think of it that way for some reason.
Well, nobody did, or you as a teenager, but your parents obviously were adults. So they might have had more of a sense of impending doom.
Well, I don't know. We all did.
You all did.
We all did. I mean, you worked every day, and we figured, are we going to survive this thing? I mean, and then we just went about our business. We still went to movies and worked, and I don't know. Life went on.
Amazing.
I mean, somehow, yeah.
Let me just identify us, and we'll be right back with Rochelle Friedkin. You are listening to AM 1460. This is Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Lubensold. My co-host today is Connie Kennedy. You're listening on WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in Honolulu, Hawaii, Beeville, Texas, Wing, North Dakota, or Shippee Bend, Tennessee, you have logged on to www.wvox.com and you are listening live. Okay, Rochelle, we've touched on this, but did you do anything extraordinary to escape detection when you were on a mission, or you just kind of acted like I belong here? And was there any?
Oh no, acted natural.
Just act natural.
Yeah,
did you have any?
Natural.
Did you have any problem with that? Were you nervous ever? Did German soldiers or French police look at you in ways that kind of made you, particularly perhaps when you were carrying these pamphlets? Did you think they were going to ask you for papers and maybe get suspicious? Did you think about it?
Well, I guess it once in a while entered my mind, but I didn't dwell on it, and I didn't think too much of it, and I just I just did it, that's all.
So you felt kind of Teflon.
Well, I suppose so. Yeah, it's not going to happen to me, you know, that sort of thing.
Now,
yeah.
Tell us, you mentioned this anecdote where your mother used to take you to a farm because food was in short supply, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, my mother was extraordinary.
And how did she go about, this is Rosa, how did she go about feeding the family and taking care of business?
Yeah, well, I don't know how she did it, but she was able to befriend these people. She would go to the farm. I went with her one time, and we sat down and we talked for an hour about how hard they told us how hard things were and all that. And my mother had packets of cigarettes with her. That was a big thing. Men could get two packs a month, and my father didn't smoke. And with cigarettes, you could get all kinds of things besides money. And finally, before we left, she would say, well, do you have a little butter, some eggs? So I said, well, you know, madame, things are so hard, but all right, for you, I'll have this. And that's how she went to a grocery store, and she was able to buy things. She befriended this grocer, and with the she showed the rations, but she didn't have enough ration coupons for all that. But he sold pasta and rice and things like that. I mean, we were never hungry. When she went to those farms, she had to go outside of the city of Grenoble, and there were checkpoints manned by the Germans, and she had to show her papers, all those Russian papers she had to show, and she risked her life practically daily to feed her family. She was really amazing. And we never were hungry.
And your father also, who lived to age 91, yeah. He was a hardworking man.
Oh, he worked all the time. He worked under any circumstances. I mean, and my mother carried the merchandise, and she brought it, and he made the bags, and it was just an amazing thing.
So your family actually was quite together.
Oh yes,
And you worked well together, and member of the resistance. Was your sister Evelyn, and were your parents also members,
no,
or were you the only active member?
My sister was a child, and eventually, since things were not even safe for children in convents, because the Germans picked up some girls in convents. So it was decided she would go to Switzerland. So she went with a group. They were smuggled to Switzerland. But before that, it seems that the smuggler, we heard the smuggler was arrested. We didn't hear anything. We were supposed to get a phone call. The children were safe, and we didn't get anything. And we thought for 3 days, we thought the children were taken by the Germans. I mean, it was just horrible. But finally, we found out that it was the French police who had arrested the smuggler, and they had stopped the group of kids. But instead of taking them to the Germans, at that time the war was changing. The Allies were started to win. It was March 1944, so they brought them to a boarding school at the border, French-Swiss border. And the people there smuggled them to Switzerland, and finally we heard that they were safe. I mean, it was like an absolute miracle that those children were safe.
More miracles. Connie, you had a question?
What stress your parents were living under during
those
days.
Oh yes, absolutely horrible.
Right. Now, absolutely. What was the decision that made them decide to send her? Things got really, really bad, right?
Yes, because, well, first they thought she would be safe in a Catholic school. And then we had some friends who had their daughters in convents, the same age, because the church helped a lot. And so they were able to take about half a dozen kids in each convent. And by accident, the mother, one of the girls who was in a convent, was arrested by the Germans on the roundup. And on her person, they found a letter from her daughter with the address. And so they went and they picked up the girl. Mm. So the children were not safe in a convent. They were not safe anywhere. So that's where they made that tough decision, especially my mother. They pushed to have her enrolled in this group, yeah.
And at that time, you also went to live with a girl from your office. She sensed you were in danger and offered to have you come live with her?
Yes, it was very strange. Nobody knew I was Jewish, of course. But this girl, for somehow she guessed. She must have known people. I don't really know. I never really found out. So she just approached me one time and she said, if you ever feel that you want to live somewhere else, my parents have a nice little house and they have room. And it was sort of understood. So I took her up on her offer. And well, my parents were very happy that I would be somewhere that was safe, because living there, I wasn't registered anywhere. And so it was really a very good deal for me. And they said, they told their neighbors I was in Nice. They were very nice to me. And I stayed there until the liberation.
You were in Nice and they were very nice to you.
Yes.
Well, it's such a powerful story. I think you have to lighten it up with a chuckle. Connie,
well,
what else?
Also, lighten it up. I read that when your parents wanted to send your sister Evelyn to a convent, she didn't want to go, and she threatened to convert.
Yes, she did. Oh yes. She was terrible. Oh yes. No. She didn't want to go to a convent. Yes. No way.
Now, Rochelle. Jews who lived in Europe during World War II, during the Holocaust, lost people. Your family, you lost some people.
Oh, yes. On my mother's side, we figure she lost about 16 people.
She cousins, had, closer?
Brothers. Brothers. Oh, yes. She had the three brothers.
So your uncles.
And my sister, my uncle.
Went to the ovens.
Yes. And then she had two sisters in Poland with families. And, of course, we never heard from them again either. And, well, it was a cousin I was very close to. She was about my age. She was taken with her parents, and that was it. Oh, yes, it was
in
very
France
close
she
to
was
her.
Taken?
Oh, yes, in Paris, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. And another uncle with his wife, the children somehow escaped. And one uncle was in Belgium. I mean, yeah, she lost a big part of her family.
So so now you've lived many years in this country, and that's all in your past. Of course, obviously, we never forget things like that, obviously.
Oh, no.
what are your feelings today towards that period, towards Germans? Do you have any lasting unease with Germans, as many Jews do?
Well, it's in the past. I mean, this is three generations later, and you cannot hold people responsible for things that their grandparents did. I mean, I don't feel. But myself, I would never go to Germany. I mean, some people went. They either vacation or else for a pilgrimage, concentration camps. They visited. Well, I wouldn't be able to do that. But I wouldn't go. I just wouldn't go to Germany. I just wouldn't. I don't know. It doesn't make too much sense. But I don't have any special feelings one way or another. Tom and German people, they're people, and they certainly
so
did.
You can treat a German
person. Of course. Oh, sure. They're
well, people. Human emotion is not that easy to
well, that's
to
true.
Brush
that's
off.
True. I would feel if I went to Germany, what was your grandfather doing? Or if I would see an old person, what did you do, during the war? I would feel that way. Yeah. I just could never go there.
Now, one thing you said also is that one way that Jews were able to elude detection is people really don't know what Jews look like.
Oh, in France? No, they don't know. The French people don't know what at that time anyway. They certainly didn't know. There were not that many Jews in France. No, they didn't know anything about Jews at all.
So they probably were looking for some stereotyped horns on the head.
Something,
and,
yeah, probably, they, yeah.
Some people really do believe that Jews have horns.
Oh, at that time, I think they did. In some parts of France, they probably
I think even
did.
In this country, some people do. attention, everyone out there, Jews do not have horns, at least not the ones I know. And dress. Certainly when you see the very religious Hasidic Jews and other Jews, they wear a certain very, this is me. They walk down the street, I am Jewish.
Yeah, oh,
but the rest of us who don't dress like that, how do you know?
Yes, that's true. But one thing that was wonderful when I came to this country, the first Rosh Hashanah, first of all, those cards, those New Year's cards in the windows. I mean, you know, we were very discreet about those things, and everybody's dressed up and goes to shul. And oh, I thought that was so wonderful that they didn't, you know, they could walk around and say, "Well, I'm Jewish," you know,
yeah.
It's fine. And I mean, we could never do that under the best of times in France.
Now, one last quick question: were the Jewish traditions observed underground in France, like the Passover Seders and other observances, Yom Kippur and all? Did you quietly and in your own space practice those?
Well, we didn't. I suppose some people may have.
People
I don't know,
have.
But
yeah.
No, we didn't. We didn't. That was the further things of our mind. But of course, after the liberation of Grenoble, Rosh Hashanah, we all went to the services because we wanted to get together with other Jewish people. It wasn't a question of religion, even, you know.
Just
so that was different.
Well, Rochelle, it's been wonderful having you here, really.
Well, it was my pleasure.
So it's
thank you so
mutual
much.
Assure. And Connie, thank you very much
for
participating as well. I'd like to thank Barry Charles Hoffman and Rochelle Fradkin for joining me in the studio today, and Connie Kennedy. If you enjoy orchestral music, you are truly in for a treat if you attend the Westchester Chamber Orchestra concert this Saturday, or any other time, really. This Saturday is, if you like, real chamber music, Telemann, Bach, wonderful, wonderful. That's this Saturday at Iona College in New Rochelle. And think on the walking miracles of this world and how the world would be had they been identified and assassinated by the Nazis. Think, too, on those whom you love, be they family or friends, who would never have been born had their parents and grandparents been so identified. I, for one, would not be here. Our thought for the week: every problem has a gift for you in its hands. Stay tuned to WVOX, your quintessential community radio station, the flagship of Whitney Radio. Thank you very much for listening. Remember to be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. You are here, and it is now. Health and happiness to you all.
Golden Apple, this is the flagship station of the Whitney Radio Network, 1460 WVOX New Rochelle.
AP Radio News. Morning, I'm John Belmont.